Sticks. Chapter 16. The doctor in the long white coat stands back and adjusts the splint on my left hand. Her face looks tired. She says she's got a boy just my age. Like that's supposed to make me feel better. Two nurses help a man with a bloody eye lie down. Mom is standing next to the doctor, looking plenty worried. "It's a mean sprain you've got," the doctor says. "You're lucky it didn't fracture. Are you right-handed or left?"
"Right."
"Well," she says, "at least that's something." "I'm a pool player," I shout. "I've got a tournament in 4 weeks." She shakes her head. "No pool for 3 to 4 weeks, Mickey. I've got to practice." "Not with that sprain," she says firmly. "You've got to let it heal." I flop back on the hospital cot. "The tournament!" The doctor sits down. "I'm sorry about that, Mickey, but that hand is a mess. I don't want you using it for anything. We'll check you in 3 weeks." "That's not enough time." I close my eyes and try to push back the tears. I might as well be dead for being so stupid. Mom puts a hand on my shoulder, and I just lose it, crying and sobbing like a baby. Mom drives me home. I can't talk. We pull up in front of Vernon's and see the poster for the tournament in the window. "We're looking for the best, and that could be you." I close my eyes. I can't look at it. It won't be me. Poppy's all upset, and Big Earl's saying, "Okay now, you're going to get through it." I don't tell him he's wrong. I'm not going to get through it. To beat Buck, I have to practice every day. Camille comes over and hugs me, which she hasn't done for a long time. She makes me her special hot milk chocolate with little marshmallows. But I can't eat the marshmallows because I need a spoon and I'm using my good hand to hold the mug. I can't put on my pajamas without everything hurting. I get put to bed like a baby with the medicine the doctor gave me for pain. Nothing ever hurt worse. Mom pulls the covers over me like she did when I was small. I feel like my whole wrist has been chopped off. Mom touches my head. "Oh, sweetie." I bite my lip and start to cry. "I have nothing smart to say, Mickey. I just want you to know that it's not going to hurt forever. I know it seems like it will, but it's not." She kisses my forehead. "Keep that hand elevated. That's what the doctor said." I can't believe I didn't listen to Joseph. It's been a long, mean school week. I sleep a little and wake up, and the pain's still there, hovering over me like a thick, dark cloud. I failed Joseph Alvarez, failed the Vernons, and the postcards keep coming from Thunder Bay. "Remember to center stroke the ball." From Toronto. "Remember, easy stroke, easy win." I'm not winning anything. I can't get my coat on without help. I can't get my book bag on my back without someone lifting it up there because I have to wear a stupid sling. "I can do it myself," I scream at Mom when she tries to help me. "Sit down," she says. I sit, but I don't want to hear. "Let me tell you about something that I am well acquainted with, Mickey. Disappointment. When you look it in the face, admit how much it hurts. When you can forgive the people involved, including yourself, you can move on." Her face looks gray. "I don't always follow my own advice. I wish someone had told me this when I was your age. It would have made things..." "I'm okay," I lied, trying to zip my pockets. Mom's eyes are so sad they take over her face. "Think about what I said. I'm too busy being miserable. I can't take gym. I can't do good work on my Zulu warrior mask in art because I need my left hand to hold it steady while I'm painting. I'm researching my soldier letter. Arlen and I both picked Valley Forge as the place where our soldiers were stationed. It was such a bad winter for the American Army. Not enough food, cold weather, sickness. They'd lost some important battles, too. All their hope was gone while the British hung out in Philadelphia, warm and well-fed. History sure can be hard. I'm trying to picture Lieutenant John Q. Milner, wondering how he felt. I'm pretty sure my wrist is never going to get better. Everybody keeps asking me how I hurt my hand. I'm sick of telling. Arlen and I are painting the poster, "The Amazing Secrets of the Pool Table." Arlen's really worried because Francine talked Marna into spying on Rory, And the news is not good. Rory's building a 5-foot erupting volcano that's getting delivered to town hall in a truck. How, Arlen shrieks, do we compete with a volcano? I shake my head and look at my bandage. I come home from school and go up the back way so I won't have to walk through the pool hall. I stick cotton balls in my ears so I can't hear the click-click of the pool balls below my room. Everyone's doing the chores I can't do. Poppy gets more cooking and vacuuming. Mom takes out the garbage. Camille gets more laundry. Camille's getting sick of it, too. I know you can't help it, she says, coming back from Crystal's with a basket of folded clothes, but I have a life. I have a fashion debut I'm trying to get ready for. I'm sorry. Then she goes into her room where she stays up late and sews. I'm replaying every dumb move I made with Buck. It's like a movie running through my head. Mrs. Cassetti is bringing me cookies from the bakery. Mrs. Kopchnik asked if I wanted to help him take apart an old vacuum cleaner. Mr. Gatto said I could have any candy bar I wanted every day until I was better. I just want my hand back. It's purple and swollen, and I feel the hurt going up my arm to my elbow. Sometimes kids push past me in school and bang my hand without meaning to, and I have to stop where I'm at until the pain passes. Arlen's upset. He's forgetting things again. He lost his Red Sox cap, left his book bag in the park, forgot his vocabulary sheet 3 days running. I'm not helping him remember like I should. I'm not much good to anybody, that's what Camille says. She's been in a foul mood. She messed up one of the costumes for the play and had to fix it and help with dinner because Mom's got citizens patrol tonight. By the time Camille slams the pasta and meatballs on the table, anything good about eating is over. Poppy has to work late. Lucky her. I've had it, Mother. I feel like a slave. Mickey just sits around here doing nothing while I'm doing stuff. Right. You eat, sleep, and talk about Joseph Alvarez. I'm sick of hearing that man's name. Mom puts her fork down. Camille, that's enough. Camille shakes her head. No. All he does is talk about Joseph Alvarez like he's dad coming back or something. Camille pushes away her dinner plate and starts crying. I don't know why Daddy didn't send someone to look in on me. Mom reaches out to her. Oh, honey, I try so hard not to think about Daddy, but sometimes I just need to have him here so bad. Mom's staring straight ahead. I understand. We're all looking down at the table. I say, I think Joseph Alvarez came for all of us. Camille's standing now. No, he didn't. He doesn't care about me. He's helping you with pool, and he's helping you with your game, Camille. If I don't like pool. I don't like living in this town. I feel like I don't belong anywhere. Mom gets her car keys and the big mega flashlight the Citizens Patrol uses. Camille starts running out of the dining room, and Mom grabs her arm. We're all going, she says, right now. I've only ridden on patrol a few times. It's so cool. I'm in the front seat of the Chevy with Mom, feeling at least 13. Camille's in the back seat, not talking. Mom's driving slowly down Flack Street, past the fix-it shop, Cassetti's bakery. I'm watching hard for anything suspicious. Open doors, trucks parked where they shouldn't be. Camille, Mom says, I can't make you care for a place that I love. I wish I could. I don't even know if I can explain to you what this town means to me. I've lived so many places I didn't care about that finding one that was special was a gift. There isn't much in Cruxton that's pretty much the way we think beauty should be. There isn't much here that distinguishes us from other places. We don't live above Vernon's because I'm still hanging on to the ghost of your father. We stay because the values that I hold dear in this world, loyalty, hard work, love, determination, are here. And there's no better way I know to teach my children what I believe in and care about than to have us live in a place where they see these things happening around us every day. Mom turns left down Mariah. I've never told either of you this. I could never count on my father. He'd go off places and come back weeks later than he said he would. He'd promise we'd go on vacations, promise he'd be there for us. He just couldn't stick around or didn't want to. It was awful for my mother. For a long time, it was hard for me to trust people and feel secure. I look at Mom. I don't know what to say. I hold up my bad hand because it's beginning to ache. Mom points to the apartments above the stores lining Moriah Boulevard. When your father died, all these people poured out to comfort me. They didn't give me pat promises at the funeral. They didn't tell me that everything was going to be all right. They stood with me. They cried with me until it was all right. No one here is a fancy dresser, Camille, and the colors you love so much aren't in grand display. But if you can focus your eyes to look inside the hearts of these people, you will see a rainbow of colors. That's what I see. That's why I stay. Camille's crying soft in the back seat. Mom, I'm so sorry. Mom hands her a tissue. I know. I turn to Camille and say there's no hard feelings. Camille nods and keeps crying. Mom lets me shine the flashlight back and forth along the row of cars behind the fence at Zeke's Towing. The light's so strong it shines anything bad out of hiding. A rat runs underneath the load truck. Mom picks up the cellular phone the phone company donated to the patrol and punches buttons. This is Ruth at the south end, she says into the receiver, looking past St. Xavier's onto Botts Street. It's looking safe and sound from here. The next morning, I'm in my room lying on my lower bunk bed on the quilt that Mom dyed pool room green to go with the pool ball pillows Camille made for me. She dyed the curtains green, too, which Arlen says just multiplies the experience. I put my autographed collection of the pool greats of the world in my closet because I don't want to look at it. Joseph Alvarez just got back from Canada. I hear the Peterbilt and don't get up. I don't want him to see me like this. I can hear him running up the stairs, hear him talking to Mom, hear his big boots clomping on the floor as he moves towards my room. He knocks on my door. It's open. He walks in, sad. Looks at my splint. Oh, son. I'm sorry. I fight hard not to cry. I can't play in the tournament. You don't know that for sure now. I start shouting that even if I can play, I can't play good enough to win because I can't practice for being an idiot. Joseph Alvarez stands there holding his hat. I'm so sorry, Mickey. We don't say anything for the longest while. Joseph Alvarez puts down his hat and starts talking about living in Mexico when he was a boy. His family was poor. His mother sold flowers on the street. His father drove a taxi. He said once some tourists were riding by his village on horses, going fast through the streets, and a girl fell off her horse, hurt bad. All the people in the village came out to help. The women brought water, the children brought cloth for bandages, and the men lifted the girl, gentle, into an old truck and took her to the hospital where the doctor fixed her up. See, we're all connected to each other, he says. Some people you just know for an instant, others are for life. And when things get bad, like when we get hurt, we've got to let the people around us help. I don't say anything. Have you been going to the hall, he asks. No. You've got to start doing it, son, watching people play the game. You'll be playing soon. Learn from their game. Play them in your head. Everybody makes mistakes. I'm a living testimonial to that. I'm standing now, shoving out my bandaged hand toward him. The tournament's 2 weeks away. I'm not going to beat Buck. He'll be too old to compete next year. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Chapter 17. 3 days pass. Nobody mentions my hand. I'm sitting at the kitchen table eating Oreos when Poppy slaps her fist on the table. Listen up, because I'm only going to say this once. I'm about to tell her I've had a pretty hard day at school. People would pay a lot of money for the advice I'm about to give you, Mickey Vernon. I don't talk much about the arthritis I've got in my hands. I don't think complaining about things makes them any better. But my hands hurt every day. Sometimes I wonder if it's worth getting out of bed, but then I've got to go to the bathroom and suddenly the trip seems worth it. She puts her hand on my shoulder. You've just got to keep walking through it, honey. Don't run, don't hide, just walk. Eventually it's going to get better. It won't stay like this forever. She takes 3 Oreos from the bag and leaves me there. Arlen and I are walking the long way back to my house. From his house, Pax Shankus Hole. We saw Buck and Pike Lorry hanging by Woolworth's and figured a detour was better than getting beat up. Other than people sitting on the pool tables and misusing the equipment, Shankus Holes gets Poppy, along with everyone else in town, the most upset about life. I look past the danger signs around the fenced-off construction site and stare into the big hole into the ground. The bulldozers made it 2 years ago when Mr. Shankus was going to build his restaurant and revitalize Flax Street until he ran out of money, and just left it there as an eyesore 4 blocks from Vernon's and made himself the most hated man in all of Cruxton, New Jersey. Quitter. That's what people call him. He could have made a difference, and he quit. Quit on his responsibilities, quit on the people who were counting on him, quit on his dream. I look down in Shankus Hole and feel my dream buried in the dirt. Arlen takes out his mechanical pencil, calculator, and a pad of paper from his book bag. At least I helped him remember it today. I've been doing some figuring, he says, punching calculator buttons. According to my calculations, you shouldn't be depressed. What? Figuring, he says, the average lifespan for an American male is about 73, and given the fact that you're 10, you have lived out approximately 1/8 of your life, meaning you have about 63 good years left. I sniff. If you were ancient, like in your 40s, I'd say, stay depressed. More than half your life is gone. There might not be another tournament. But at 10, Mickey, you're going to have a lot more opportunities to nail Buck and a ton of other guys. Arlen's punching buttons like crazy. And, he says, this 3-week setback only represents less than 0.1% of your life, assuming you're going to make 73, but you could last longer. You could live to be 100, in which case you're looking at 0.06%, which is basically nothing in the whole sphere of the universe. My dad died young, Arlen. Arlen's calculating away and writing down numbers. Even if you don't go as long as the averages and you go a lot earlier, you're still talking small percentages. If I were you, I'd definitely feel better. The numbers don't lie. Arlen puts the calculator back in his pocket. We need to go down the hall, he says, and he starts off down the street. I stand there. Arlen turns to me. Are you going to argue with math? It's the first time I've set foot in Vernon's for 10 days. I love the echoes the ball makes when they jump in the pocket. I love the way the pool sticks hang on the wall like soldiers. I love the way Buck misses easy shots when we make gasser noise at him. I stand at table 21 and roll the white cue ball across the empty table. Take it slow. Arlen is holding the mechanical bridge. That's an extender for the pool stick, and I'm shooting one-handed. And I'm going to use whatever I can to make my game better. A siren's blaring in the distance. Buck's kissing his stick and dancing with it in the corner. I look away and concentrate. I miss a lot of shots at first. It's frustrating. But slowly I get the hang of playing one-handed. I line up the shot and tap. 3 in the side. Not perfect, but not bad. Arlen stays for dinner so we can work on our science fair project. Mom is at night school. Camille is at a dress rehearsal for her play. Poppy makes us macaroni and cheese, which her mother used to make for her when she was pushing on homework assignment. Poppy says her mother's macaroni and cheese has special brain-enlarging calories that have never yet failed her, which is why she's such an intelligent fireball to this day. We're leaning over the dining room table. Arlen just finished drawing the sheet that shows our angles. The angles the ball makes off the rail, and the angles where the cue ball hits the object wall. I say pool is cooler than volcanoes. If we just had something that explodes, Arlen says. We walk down the long hall to the living room and find the creakiest place in our floor. If you step on it just right, a creepy wailing sound. Whee! When Camille has her friend Olivia over, Arlen and I rock back and forth on the place and creep Olivia out bad. Poppy put a little hooked rug over the spot, but that just makes it easier to find. We go into the living room. Mom's palm tree by the window is dying. Poppy says we don't get enough sunlight in the living room. All the sun hits the back of the house, which is why Poppy's geraniums bloom 3 seasons in the kitchen. Sunlight isn't a big deal for me. Pool halls stay pretty much the same, day or night. Arlen and I or waiting for his mother to pick him up, and I put on the video of my dad playing pool. Arlen never minds watching it. I put it on once when Petty Pencastle was here and he wanted to watch cartoons. Poppy sits down to watch with us, even though it's hard for her. The tape's choppy, but I don't care. Dad's wearing a blue shirt. He shoots some awesome shots, and the video cuts to me as a baby, sitting in a high chair picking my nose. 8 ball in the side, Dad says to me, and I stop picking and watch. Dad makes the shot, and I clap my pudgy little hands. I'm just watching the memories. I don't remember spilling out. Poppy wipes away a tear. Dad's bending over the table, shooting ball after ball. Bam! Pow! In they go. He said he could sometimes see a line going from the cue ball through the object ball right into the pocket, Poppy says softly. Arlen and I sit up. What kind of line, we say together. I don't know. He said it was like a line showing him the way. Arlen looks up to heaven and closes his eyes. He does this when he's getting math ideas. He gets out the graph paper and starts drawing a pool table and ball with lines shooting through it. His mother comes to the front door, which doesn't interest him much. He had an idea, I tell Mrs. Pepper. She plops down. We could be here all night. Arlen's drawing like mad, measuring lines and drawing angles. This, he declares, is unbelievable. Chapter 18. Arlen pleads his mother, math will wait. Your father will not. We have to go. Arlen turns toward his mother. Mom, do you know what Galileo said? Arlen brings out the big guns. Galileo is a dead scientist who used a lot of math. He's one of Arlen's heroes. Arlen puts his hand over his heart. Galileo said the universe stands continually open to our gaze, but it cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and interpret the characters in which it is written. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometrical figures, which without it is humanly impossible to understand a single word. Without these, one is wandering about in a dark labyrinth. A labyrinth is like a maze. Arlen had this quotation on the Galileo poster in his room. 15 minutes, says Mrs. Pepper, and takes out her knitting. She makes a pink sweater. Arlen draws a ball on a piece of paper and another ball with a line through it heading for a pocket. A vector, he says, is a line that takes you from one place to the next. That means your father was using vectors to make his shots. He could see the lines going from the balls to the pockets like they were drawn on the table. He didn't have math as a language, so he couldn't tell it to anyone else. His language was his stick. He could only show it. My heart is pounding. Arlen turns to Poppy. Can you remember anything about Mr. Vernon seeing the line? Poppy's thinking. Well, he just said it was kind of a shot through his eye that went through the cue ball, and he could see the table and what he was supposed to do. See the table, Arlen repeated. That's what he said. See the table, Arlen shouts. Have you ever seen those lines when you shoot, Mickey? No, I can do the angles, but I need string, Arlen yells. Mrs. Pepper holds up her pink yarn. Yes, yarn is perfect, Arlen shouts. We have to go downstairs. We have to see the table. Arlen's just scattered 9 balls on table 8 and is cutting the pink yarn in pieces. He lays a piece of yarn from each ball to its closest pocket until table 8 looks like a diagram. I think that's how your father saw it, except the lines weren't pink. He makes a face. I look at the table. It's one of those simple answers you don't think about. But each time a ball moves the lines, it'll be different, I say. You've got to train your mind to see them, says Arlen. Your dad did it naturally. And then there's English, I say. You got to be able to hit balls just right to line up your next shot. Geometry doesn't explain the way you have to hit the ball, Arlen explains. That's calculus. As I live and breathe, says Poppy, I think this'll work. I think if Poppy hadn't seen it for herself, she wouldn't have talked Mom into letting me stay up late and try the experiment. Mrs. Pepper drags Arlen halfway home, and then they come back to get his jacket. This shouldn't count, Arlen pleads to his mother as he retrieves his coat. I was helping a friend in need. Be merciful. He throws me another drawing. The pink yarn is junking up the table, so I have to take it off, brush the mat, and use the string instead. I cut different lengths, placing them on the table. Then I memorize the line that goes from the ball into the pocket and try the shot using the bridge. I make most of the shots. Poppy tries some too. "Well, I'll be," she shouts. I want to tear the bandage off my hand and start playing for real. My left hand is doing good. Mom makes me go to bed. I curl up in my green quilt and listen to the click, click of pool balls in the hall below. I study Arlen's drawing and put it under my pillow. I close my eyes and try to imagine table 8 in a big geometric pattern. The balls lying there, breaking apart, moving, and those lines going right through the balls into the pockets and slamming through Buck Pender's dirty, rotten heart. In school, I keep seeing the table. Long shots, short shots, bank shots, vectors. I'm seeing geometry everywhere. Diamond-shaped ball fields, birds flying in a V formation. I have grapes for lunch, and I think about circles. Then I ram the grapes across my tray with my straw. Wham! 2 grapes in the corner. It's all connected. Mrs. Riggle gives us extra time to work on our soldier letters, which are due tomorrow. Arlen and I are in our favorite corner in the school library, sitting in the soft brown chairs tucked behind the science fiction section. I just finished my letter. Dear Mother and Father, I'm writing to let you know how I am. Things are not as good as I would like them to be. I was shot in the arm, and my arm is in a sling, but the good news is that the feeling is okay now, although I will be a while before I get back to battle. It was frightening to be shot. I did something stupid near the battle line, and a redcoat got me, but my friends pulled me away and saved my life. I guess you know by now that we lost the Battle of Germantown and the British took Philadelphia. We feel so bad that we couldn't hold on. Retreating from that battle was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. I felt like we were letting everyone down. When I think of my comfortable home and warm bed and all the good food you supply, it's hard for me to believe what has happened to us at Valley Forge. The conditions are so hard. We had to cut down trees to make huts and burn wood for fires. There's nothing left here now that to break the wind. We're cold and hungry, and we're tired and sick. I'm told we came here last month with 12,000 men, but there won't be that many when we leave, for sure. There's no medicine, so my arm must get better on its own. And there's not much hope, either. The most hope we see comes from General George Washington. He's the finest man I've ever known. He reminds us every day that our cause is good. I trust him to do the right thing. I think he would make a great president someday. Hint, hint. Other than that, I'm doing all right. I have a torn blanket to keep me warm. I'm real lucky to have it, too. Not everyone has this much. If I get back home, I'll never take anything for granted again. Your son, John. Lieutenant John Q. Milner, Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. January 11th, 1778. Arlen finished his letter, too. He had to use his calculator. He figured how many potatoes, barrels of sauerkraut, and pounds of meat each man needed to survive for 3 months, plus how many wagons it would take to deliver the supplies. The sauerkraut had loads of vitamin C to help fight diseases like scurvy. Arlen decided that his soldier came from a rich, brave farming family who could bring the food to Valley Forge and change the course of history. Arlen said his letter would probably get his soldier promoted from private first class to at least master sergeant. My doctor's appointment is tomorrow. It's the last period of the day at school. Mrs. Riggles is standing in front of the blackboard. "What," she asks the class, "is the bravest thing you've ever done?" We all look at each other. Sally Stiletto says calling 911 when her grandmother had a stroke and helping her breathe until the ambulance came. Arlen says taking Mangler to the animal hospital without any money in a cab after he'd been hit by that motorcycle. "Were either of you frightened?" "Yeah," Arlen and Sally say together. "Courage," Mrs. Riggles says, "rarely comes without fear. Courage rises above the fear and makes people more than they think they can be." She holds up a picture of Paul Revere riding his horse. "Let's talk about the acts of courage during the Revolutionary War." I take out my history book and feel something shoot through me, like I'm connected to all the acts of courage in the whole world. Whether I get to the finals or choke in the early rounds, I know what I have to do.